Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Niels Nielsen.
And I'm John Mayer. And today we have a very, very special guest, one of the all-time great people and great players in our sport. He won the silver medal in 1996. He's won 75 tournaments. He's been best defensive player for 4 years. He's done everything. The one that I was most surprised by was he was best spiker in 1989. The guest is Mike Dodd. Thanks for coming, Mike.
Thanks, guys.
Best spiker. Is that for real?
Well, it certainly wasn't the hardest spiker, but, you know, with the larger court, if you could manage to get it around and get some side outs, I guess maybe they just gave it to me because I had to hit half sets all those years.
So. Yeah, there you go. Made him look good.
Mike, I have no idea why John sounds so surprised.
Me either.
I wanted to start out by asking you about, I guess, just how you've seen the beach game change for better and for worse since you started playing back in 1979. And I know you're one of the people who has stayed involved throughout, you know, as a coach on the international scene and the AVP. So I think you have a pretty good perspective, maybe better than most.
Yeah, I don't ever see our sport, at least in my eyes, changing for the worse. I know there's a lot of guys out there that really cling to the old way of beach volleyball. And I think what gets lost in the translation is that all of the great volleyball that's being played now and all the great players that are playing and, you know, all the people that are looking at the game as, well, it doesn't last as long and it's not as fun and there aren't as many parties or whatever. And they're not really appreciating the athleticism and how hard this game is to play. I've been fortunate enough to see a lot of great players, you know, that you know, I played with in my era and then I've coached in this era. And I've seen how hard it is to transition and to do things with the blocks being as big as they are now and the court being as small as it is. So I appreciate everything that you guys and that all the other younger players deal with trying to play this game. It's a very different game, but for me, the soul of beach volleyball never changes, and we're still outside playing a game that we love. And yeah, the rules are different, and it's you know, if you're shut off to it, you're not going to appreciate what's going on out there, but it's still a beautiful game. And still the guys, I think, that work the hardest, put in the most time and have the most talent end up on top. I think that's been the case since, you know, Gene Selznick and Ron Von Hagen, all the way through all the eras. The guys that really trained, the guys that really wanted it, the guys that were really competitive, and the guys that had God's gifts and talents rose to the top. And I don't think that's changed one bit in today's game.
That was music to my ears because I feel like playing in the new game, we get a lot of flack from the players from your era. Like, our game is easier. It's not as entertaining. It's, you know, just big doofuses can be out there and play it. And it's just, I guess it's just refreshing to hear you say that. And I think you do have, I think, a little deeper perspective on it because you have stayed so involved. What do you attribute, I guess, the golden age when you played? I would say it was kind of, you know, the late 80s, mid 90s. What do you attribute the popularity then? Is it because of the rules or what was it that made it so much bigger then?
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. We had some charismatic players that were very entertaining. We were in an era and a day that was less sensitive to political correctness, and we could have bikini contests and huge parties and build this brand of lifestyle, you know, and I think above all of us guys during that golden era, you know, we knew how great our game was and we knew how hard it was to play and all of that, but we were never so narrow-sighted to think that we weren't a young adult promotion for beer companies and for tequila companies and that we weren't a party, because we were, and that was going to be kind of our ticket to, you know, hopefully garner respect as our sport grew. I think we were all on board to do whatever we could do to help our sponsors achieve their goals through their endorsement of our sport and their off-court parties and activities and things that they would do. So it was just kind of an era where some guys that were leading our tour, especially a guy named Jeff Dankworth, put together some really creative contracts with Miller Brewing, with NBC, with NFL. And as a result, in our era, we were on for 22 hours of live network television every summer. We were on more than tennis and hockey combined. We were, we had Jose Cuervo and we had this gold crown that was amazing, an amazing three tournament series. But outside of that, we were the property of Miller Brewing, and they were proud to own us, and we got to go to Super Bowls and do promotions through Miller Brewing and go to their distributor events and cruises and just all kinds of fun stuff. But the bottom line is we had a good product. We were sexy and fun, and we marketed the heck out of it. And we had great television coverage, and as a result, we grew. And it was a wonderful ride to go on.
So, Mike, today it seems like the party atmosphere has definitely changed, especially internationally. Like, I can't see that having anything to do with the rule changes, like the court being a little shorter so you don't party as much. Is it just is it the personality of the players, or is it kind of like the way management is pushing a more professional-looking event? What do you think it is?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. I know my era, even though we kind of reaped the most benefits financially from all of the roller coaster of what our sport has gone through and the good times and the bad, the core of our group, which was Karch and St. John Smith and Randy Stoklos and Pat Powers and John Stevenson and Tim Hovland and myself, we grew up in the era of no money. So I think there was something irreverent about us that even when the money started coming, we still had a kind of irreverence about it. We weren't like these robotic kind of athletes that, not to say that the players now are robotic, but we were still real social and fun, and we'd go out. And I think a big part of what it was that we would go out and party with our fans. And then they loved it, and they couldn't wait to watch on Monday nights on Prime Ticket, and see our games or watch them on Sunday on NBC. And I think not so much to the fault of the players, but more the Olympics and the formality of the way that the sport is being presented now, there's a disconnect between the players and the fans. The fans are out there, and the players are inside the ropes, and there's not the same connection. So it all depends on how you want to market the sport and how you want to see it grow. But there was a lot of things that we did really well in our era. First and foremost, we controlled our own merchandising. We had a little truck, and we had our AVP hats and our AVP shirts, and it was very tour specific. And my younger brother, Matthew, used to run it. And literally, he would come home from Chicago and Belmar and Boulder and some of our big tournaments with $150,000 in cash in his backpack. And when we said, okay, now we're going to be super professional, we can't just do our little merchandise out of a trailer now. We've got to do a licensing deal. And all of a sudden, we did these big licensing deals. And we set up these giant kind of shopping mall tents where people, before it was a little trailer, and it was 10 rows deep of people. And as soon as you got to the front, you had to order, man. Give me three hats. Give me five sweatshirts. Give me, three trunks. And there was a frenzy about it because you didn't want to miss out. You didn't want them to sell out. And then it became, when we went to licensing, it turned into no revenue. It was just people would shop and they'd walk around and they'd look, and we were getting 10% of whatever the licensee was. I mean, it was just silly, but it's kind of like you think, oh, well, we've got to be professional, so we've got to do it this way. Whereas I think there's a lot of things that the players can do or the AV could do on their own and do a lot better at than just thinking we've got to farm it out to other people, whether it's public relations or merchandising or whatever. We did almost all of our stuff in-house or with an agency that assigned certain people to us that just worked with us all year. And a lot of our sponsors got a lot of bang for their buck that way.
It reminds me of like my favorite bands, like a punk rock band. You guys were doing it just for the love, for the lifestyle, for the passion. And then, you know, they put out this amazing album and then they signed to a major label and the passion goes out of it. And it sounds like that's kind of what's happened. I don't feel like that's, I mean, today it's not like we're playing for money. We don't make anything. Like, we're out there because we love it. But I think there is a big corporate side to, I guess, everything we do. Like you're saying, there's more of a disconnect. But I guess my question is, you know, that party that you guys had, could you party like that and still be successful in today's game? Or I think the fields might be a little deeper and the game is a little different.
Yeah, well, you know, there's partying and there's being part of a party. Mm. And yeah, we partied, but most of the time it was after a tournament. And the parties on Friday and Saturday night, we were there. We'd have a beer, we'd walk around and we'd chat with people, but we weren't going hard. And fortunately, we had a lot of young bucks that took 17ths and 9ths, and they'd carry the load on Friday and Saturday night. And then sometimes, you know, if we weren't jetting out of town that night, we'd go to the Sunday night party, and we would party then, and it was great. You know, the tournament was over, and it was time to blow off a little steam and have fun. But we were there. We were there at all those promotional events. I mean, you know, when we went to Milwaukee, that's where Miller's corporate headquarters are. And we'd go out to biker bars on Wednesday before tournaments, you know, just to play with some biker guys and show them how to play beach volleyball at some crazy bar out in the middle of nowhere. We'd do that every week. We'd go out early and we'd do stuff. So, yeah, I think guys could be a lot more social and go to functions and, you know, they don't have to get drunk. You don't have to be that way, but you can be serving to your sponsors. You can be helping them to, you know, to achieve their goals, and you can be connecting with fans without really, you know, tying one on, so to speak. Although, you know, people think we're wild partiers. So, you know, I guess that's our image. And we did have fun, but we played excellent volleyball over long periods of time. And it wasn't a fluke. It was from being prepared and working hard.
Speaking of the Olympics, Mike, and maybe being on the other side, the most professional looking and serious looking event, how have you seen that affecting beach volleyball? And has it maybe even hurt the domestic side?
It's hurt our domestic side for sure. People are going to always argue about different things, but you know, there could be a really good argument that, you know, had the AVP players been a little more cavalier toward the Olympics, right when the Olympics was forming, because the AVP was, I mean, it was so far and away the number one tour and had the most money and the most TV. If we'd have just kind of been a little bit more like the NBA in the early years and just kind of said, screw you, this is how you play this game. This is our game. This is how we play. This is how the rest of the world should play. You know, I don't know if it would be boycotting the Olympics, but just not change everything, you know, to kind of mimic the FIVB mold and model. You know, who knows where the AVP would be right now? It still comes down to great executives and great leaders. And when we had great executives and great leaders, we flourished. And when we had executives and leaders that weren't so great, we floundered, you know, and so that's just a business, you know, that's the business part of it. But, you know, there was definitely the formality of the Olympics, which is great for the Olympics, but still, if you go to any other Olympic sport, the formality at beach volleyball is head and shoulders less formal than the rest of the Olympic venues and the rest, the way the rest of the Olympic sports are presented. I mean, there's music blaring and no, it's not Klagenfurt with go-go girls and you know, fire hoses off the canopy, but it's pretty wild compared to the rest of the Olympic events. So, I mean, I guess everything's relative, but I think as far as our tour and our domestic tour and the AVP, I would love to see them just take a step away from the formality and just kind of bring back a little bit more of and promote a little more of lifestyle and really bring sponsors in that really want to try to bring back the party, because the party was what fueled the sport and the greatness of the sport. And in the end, people have a great time and they realize the athleticism, they realize how hard the game is, but they're out there. And right now, there's certainly not the same kind of energy that used to prevail at our events. And it's really unfair to say, well, it's, you know, it's not just that. I mean, we had tournaments. I mean, we played 20 years straight in Chicago. We played Clearwater 20 years straight. I mean, we had places that we went to the same weekend every year after year. And you do that, I promise you, you do that at any site for 3 to 5 years, and that tournament will be huge. We just haven't been able to maintain the consistency, you know, the ability to just be able to lock down sites and build events that have value. I mean, that's what we had. We had big events that had value and had tradition, and you say what it's worth, but humans are humans, you know, and fans are like, oh, wow, it's mid-August. Isn't there that thing at North Avenue Beach at the end of August? And then all of a sudden there's 30,000 people there in Chicago. You know, if I were consulting with the AVP, I would say, you know, bring back the lifestyle, try to be consistent with your events and find events that are really good. Find sites that want to work with you and that there's interest and public interest and build some value. Invest in those sites. And all of a sudden you get 12 or 15, you have a real tour. You got something that's, you know, that can give young players like you guys hope to keep training and working hard, because in our era, I mean, we had some great, great players, but we had a lot of really, you know, guys that averaged 9th place, 13th place, making 80, 90 grand a year for playing beach volleyball. So I hope to God someday it gets back to that, because there'll be a lot more guys wanting to come out and play, because there's no doubt how fun the game is and how enjoyable and rewarding it is to play. So hopefully we can get back to that someday.
Amen. So I wanted to kind of change pace, and we are a coaching focused podcast. So I wanted to get into coaching a little bit. And I know in the beach game for a long time, there was no such thing as coaching. And now it's almost a necessity. You see it with almost every team. I want to just kind of hear your thoughts on the positives and negatives of that evolution.
Well, I think the positive is that the way our sport is being managed and the way the rules exist right now, I think the biggest benefits that coaching has brought to our game is in practice. You know, players are able to practice and have just another set of eyes and some film and be able to study and see errors that they're making or you know, choices that they're making. And I think that's, unfortunately, you know, I started, what was it, 2006. So, you know, 10 years have gone by since I started. And when I started, I was certainly optimistic that coaches by this point now would be able to actually coach in games, and that our coaching, the coaching of beach volleyball would have come a lot further as far as coaches' rights, coaches being part of events, coaches really being valued by our federation. I thought we would have come a lot further by now. So I'm a little bitter, kind of disillusioned old coach at this point, just because we haven't made the progress. You know, we're still, you know, sleeping on hotel floors on the FIVB tour and delegated to just stuff that just isn't right. You know, I mean, I would just kind of be somewhere in the middle of nowhere away from my family coaching the number one team in the world, saying, how come I'm coaching the number one team in my sport and I get jack squat and these guys are coaching, you know, are mediocre coaches in the NFL and make $10 million a year. I mean, where is it? You know, so it's for me, it was very frustrating. And I think we have a long way to go. And unfortunately, as is always the case with most events, it's really a matter of cost. And so the reason that we're not part of the game and the reason that we're not picked up at the airport like the players and like the refs and like is that they don't want to make us part of the game. Because if they make us part of the game, then they'd have to treat us like normal humans, you know, instead of just the ancillary aspects of an event. You know, that's what we are. We're just kind of trimming and we're helping our guys and we're studying and we're trying to make them the best they can be. And we're certainly a credit to the game and we've, you know, we're helping players to be better, which is what coaching is all about. But as far as the respect and recognition that I think a lot of coaches that have put in a lot of hard, long hours deserve, they're not getting it either on the FIVB tour or you know, even, you know, we're just starting this collegiate volleyball, you know, and there's some coaching opportunities that are presenting themselves now for that. But still, even that's got a long ways to go for great beach coach to get to the level that indoor coaches are being paid.
So other than lack of value and money, what do you think about the coach's role specifically in tournament time? Because I know like I'm coaching, it's kind of interesting for beach volleyball how it's pretty hands-off and they kind of want the players to be in charge. Because I'm coaching a lot of youth teams and they go from their indoor sport where the coach is like playing them like a joystick and telling them where to go and really directing traffic. And they come to the beach and like as a coach, you can say a couple things in a timeout, maybe when they cross the net, but it's really up to them as players. Would you see that changing or do you think there's value there in that coaching role?
Well, I hope it changes at some point where at least the coaches can communicate a little bit more with the players during play. But from the minute I started, you know, every aspect of my coaching has been geared to try to help my players to be able to think for themselves because I can't think for them, you know, and there's some core element of what beach volleyball has always been about that clings to that and wants to keep the players kind of out there making their decisions and their strategies and changing their strategies and doing stuff for themselves. So I geared everything I did in coaching beach volleyball to teaching and helping players to think for themselves. Because after you can look at film and you can say, wow, we've kept serving that guy and it didn't work, you know, and it's easy to see the mistakes after, but the great players are the ones that recognize when a strategy isn't working and change right away, not after the match is over, but mid-match, you know, change things around, change momentum, do things differently. And the more that I could teach players to think along those lines, the more I thought I could be help to them because I couldn't be a help to them during a match.
Can you give us an example of how you would do that?
Well, I think it just would come from feedback. It would come from, you know, obviously studying previous matches, but just recognizing when players are making thoughtful plays and making thoughtful changes in their strategy and rewarding them for it, saying, yeah, that was a great time to switch that serve. That was really, you know, and I mean, what else can you do? You can't give them feedback right at the moment that they're changing something or doing something that you've tried, you know, to teach them to do. So you've just got to, you know, as soon as you can after a match, let them know how well or how proud you are that they were able to recognize a weakness or recognize, you know, a change in strategy or recognize that they were approaching or doing something contrary to the way the wind was blowing. Any type of thoughtful play that you can, you know, kind of give players feedback and encouragement and let them know that they're on the right track. That was my goal.
I love that philosophy of guiding your players and letting them figure things out on their own. I know those sort of experiences will lead to a longer lasting learner and someone who can, you know, deal with adversity and all those challenging things in our sport. So I'm wondering, you've seen a lot of coaches now in the beach game. What is to you, the bad side of coaching? What are coaches doing out there that is hurting their players or that isn't as effective?
You know, I know that there are coaches that kind of are more of a get in your face, scream type of coach and mentality and emphasize winning, which I've never particularly endorsed. I've always been more of a process kind of guy, and let's do what we need to do to be better the next play and the next day and the next week. And not so much that winning or being perfect at any skill or fundamental at this very moment is imperative, because I just never felt that that was a good way to maximize my players' kind of learning curve. And I just didn't think it's contrary to my personality. And, you know, I've seen some coaches that are really kind of can be negative and aggressive and put a lot of pressure on their players. And, you know, sometimes they get results, sometimes they don't, but that's just not my style.
I'm curious, what do you think the golden age in your era would have looked like if every team had a coach?
I don't know. I don't think it would change much as far as whether it would make it less of a golden age or more of a golden age. I think coaching is really something that, you know, is an element of raising the level of play, you know. And so if everybody would have had a coach in our era, it goes to reason that our level of play would have been raised as well. But again, we were playing in a different era. We were playing in an era where we would go down to the beach at you know, 10 in the morning, and we would play till 2 or 3 or even later into the afternoon, and we would play game after game after game. And it was a slower lifestyle. There wasn't the internet. There weren't cell phones. There wasn't, you know, there wasn't all this urgency to go out and go, I don't know, do whatever you're doing, you know. And we loved the beach and we hung out there. And so I think coaches could have definitely helped us, but we were playing so much and we were pushing ourselves so much that we were able to achieve some pretty high levels of fundamentals and knowing, you know, the nuances of the game and just knowing the wind and knowing all the little things. They were just almost second nature to us, I think, because we just played a lot more. You know, there's just, society is different now. You just have to get out and you're either having to work or do something or take care of your family or do whatever. But, you know, in our time, it was a little different, but I still believe that had there been coaches, maybe all of us would have not wanted them to coach us, you know, because we were free spirits. But I think it would have helped the level of play, because I think coaching does that. So, you know, and it's really funny. For me, the biggest difference, I mean, John, you saw me when I coached Jake and Rosie, or Phil and Rosie. It was minutia. It was very, I talked very little. There were very finite micro things to do, because you guys are professionals and you already know stuff. And now with this EDP program, I leave the beach after 2 hours without a voice, because I am talking constantly, because there's so much more for young players to learn and to grasp and to figure out. And they're not on the beach all day. And so they've got to try to figure it out faster, because they're going to go back to class or wherever they're going. And they're on the beach for 2 hours. And so it's just a different brand of coaching at the collegiate level. It's been really fun for me to work with younger players that aren't professional yet, that don't know everything, that really get so much more of my knowledge, kind of, because they need it.
And just to clarify, EDP is
Elite Development Program.
Okay, it's basically the USA training program. Just anybody doesn't know what that is.
Yeah. So, Mike, I've heard this a lot, and it sounds awesome. The idea of back in the day playing workup courts and just playing games all day long. Do you see that changing mostly because of a rule change, or maybe just the evolution of practices, or could we get something out of playing all day long? Are we missing something by doing our 2 hours of drills? And then also to follow that, like, what does a Mike Dodd practice look like?
First of all, I think you are missing something by not playing all day on a beach. I think it has to do with just all the little crazy, silly plays that happen in beach volleyball. I think the longer you're out there and the more you're playing and the more games you play, the better you get at all those whacked out little plays and balls out of the net and all those little things that can definitely mess with young players. I mean, I think 100% it's the nature of the game. Our game was a marathon. It was endurance volleyball. It was not, we had to train for those long hours because that's what we played, 3 hour matches. We played, you know, from 8 a.m. until 6 p.m. You know, we play 4 or 5 matches in a day. It was a different game. The game today is a sprint. You're sprinters. You're not marathoners anymore. And so I think that the training that you guys are doing is right on par with the style of game that is played now. But I do think that you do miss out a little bit. I mean, just those days were some of the best days of my life. You know, you wake up and you play, and then you know, we'd be down at Marine Street in Manhattan Beach, and then we'd go up to Sloopy's and get a sandwich. Then we'd go back and we play more games in the afternoon, and you'd go in the water and you'd surf and you'd come out and you'd sit around, and these old guys like Mike Cook and Walt Schiller would be playing these games of Dirty Deuce. And I mean, it was just a whole, there was a social fabric around the game. It wasn't just training. Now it's training. It's not your whole life, you know. It was our whole life, and like I said, there was a lot less to do in our day, so maybe that was part of it. But it was for me, it was more, you know, for us guys that were really, really serious about it, we were just training the way we felt like we needed to train to win a war, to just go out and play for 10 or 12 hours in really hot weather and really long matches, being out there on the court Monday through Friday and staying on that court and winning as many games as you can and getting that full day in. That was everything to us.
It makes me want to get in my DeLorean and go back and be a part of that. And it sounds so cool. Sounds like such a cool thing to be
I mean,
part
of. I know I'm very, you know, antiquated, but you know, if I agree with you, John, if I had a time machine, I'd go back. I don't really have a strong desire to go 50 years in the future and see what the world's going to be like. I'd like to go back to Amsterdam in the 60s and watch the Beatles play. You know, I'd love to do some of that stuff. And
well,
you guys would have fun if you came back to our era and live that kind of lifestyle, you know. When you're young, you have families and things change and time constraints and jobs and the fact that you can't play right now and really make the kind of living that you want to make just from volleyball. It all of that stuff has led almost all of our players to this condensed version of, you know, getting as many touches as humanly possible in the 2 hour time frame that you have during the day to get it done.
Thanks for listening to part one. We'll have more from Mike Dodd next week on Coach Your Brains Out.
It all comes down to this. Dodd and Whitmarsh have to score this point or the tournament is over. If they score it, we go to 7-7. Not yet! Dodd! They got it!
what does a Mike Dodd practice look like, especially in the new era now with trying to get as many touches as possible in the 2 hour span? How do you structure that?
And also, is there an important role in humor in practice?
I think so. I think practice should be fun. I think that part of our job as coaches should be to remind players that it's pretty unique and pretty lucky what we're doing. You know, we're out here in this beautiful environment, getting exercise and striving to be great at something. That's not a horrible situation. You know, we could be digging ditches in Flint, Michigan in 30 degrees below zero weather, you know, and we're not doing that. So, you know, I always try to bring some humor and keep certain elements of the practice light. I think that if I could describe my coaching, I try to design drills and practices that are progressive, that take core principles and fundamentals of beach volleyball and build them step by step, starting with serving and ending with passing and focusing on those two skills more than any for every level. And then, you know, building all of everything from serving and passing, because I don't think you can play this game very well if you can't. The sooner you can master those skills, in particular passing, you know, for young players, it takes a little bit longer to get the serving down. But to enjoy this game for as long as you play, which can be for a really long time, you have to be able to control your platform. To me, the platform is still the end all and be all of ball control. I still think that a player that can maneuver their platform and be able to direct the ball and control the ball and buffer the ball and do all of those elements with their platform is going to be light years ahead of defenders that are constantly, you know, with their hands raised, trying to take almost every ball from over their hand as opposed to with their platform. I just think that when I think of an athletic position, when I think of a cornerback in football, they don't usually have their hands up. They have their hands down and they have their feet staggered and they're ready to guard, you know, a wide receiver that's like a jet flash. And I think that's the most athletic position you can be in. And that should be the position that you play the majority of this game in. So I kind of have drills in two categories that are, you know, fundamentals and skill driven categories, and then competitive and game like drills, wash drills. And, you know, John, how much I love 5-3 and, and I like to try to devise drills that somehow can create some kind of pressure, because it's hard to really to recreate the pressure that you feel in a real match and playing in a real final in practice. Let's face it, it's impossible. But if you can try to manage, you know, and I was always trying to get guys to bet each other lunches and put something on it or do something just to create some type of pressure and some type of added, you know, like that you got to get it done. I constantly try to put that in my competitive drills. So, you know, there's drills that you really need to focus on the fundamentals and that you can control. And then there's other, you know, the more competitive drills that you're actually playing the game and competing that I try to create a lot of pressure.
So when I think about you, I think of you as being a good partner, someone who could play with a lot of different personalities. I know you played with quite a few different personalities. Obviously, Tim Hovland and was a big one. But I'm wondering what you think about the importance of being a good teammate and what some of the characteristics that make a good partner or a good teammate.
Well, I think you know, if passing is the fundamental element to enjoy and play beach volleyball at a high level, I think the mentality of of being a great teammate, of taking whatever set your partner gives you and doing something with it without frowning, of taking whatever shank pass your partner gives you and giving them a good set and a good call. I think that is, to me, what a great player is. I'm not impressed with a guy that bounces the ball. I'm not impressed with a guy that jump serves a gazillion miles an hour. I'm impressed with the player that makes their partner better. And, and Karch, to me, that was really the essence of his greatness. Was he was great. He made Brent Frohoff way better than Brent Frohoff was on his own. He made Scott Akatubby way better than Scott Akatubby was. He made Kent great. Kent was actually great on his own, really great. He made St. John great, and St. John was great on his own. But Karch, I was fortunate enough to play in 5 tournaments with him, and it was just easy. It was just, he did so many good things, and yeah, you felt pressure because you wanted to play well with this guy that was so great, but that was pressure that I put on myself. But, to me, the great, great players are the ones that every play, every contact are wanting to make their partner better. Because really, every play that you have, outside of receive, even with receiving serve, because you're receiving your opponent's serve, but you're trying to give your partner a good pass. Every contact that you make in volleyball, when you think about it, is in one way or another trying to help your partner be better. Whether, like I said, it's taking their bad pass and making a good set, or taking their bad set and making, a good shot or a smart hit. It's just something that builds on itself, and it's mental. It's all mental. I mean, you just got to want to, and it's not easy, because you've been out there on that island where your partner is just struggling, and you can't think of anything else you can do to help them. And you've been in those moments where you let your emotions get the best of you, and you gave them some type of negative body language or negative verbal, help or whatever. And then your team's really gone to hell in a handbasket. You just have to, and again, it's mental toughness. It's not easy to just think that every play, every time, everything I've got to do to make this guy better. But the great players do that. They really do.
Love that.
Is there anything that you do to try to help players become more aware of how important that is, or maybe even a drill that you have?
Well, I think it's more the feedback that you give them through the course of any drill. When a player makes a really good first contact, and let's say it's an over dig and they're stuck at the net, and they really thoughtfully lift the ball, and the other player thoughtfully comes in and with a really good approach and hits on two, I try to give really good feedback while they're competing. What I often say, turn a lemon into lemonade. When they take a really poor play and turn it into a good play through their skill and their mental toughness or whatever. And to me, I don't think there's a drill that teaches you to just want it. It just has to be kind of a cumulative process of training. And, the more that I can give feedback to players that are doing that, that I see doing it on the court, that I see are making a difference for their partner, I'm going to let them know about it in a really loud, positive, fun fashion. Cause I think that's the key to developing the mindset, because that's really what it is. It's so mental to want to be a good partner and to need to be a good partner and to be smart enough to realize that making your partner the best they can be is your best chance of winning. You're with who you're with. So you either can be down on them when they're not playing well, or you can do everything in your power to help them. And more often than not, when you do stuff like that, they pull out of it and you win a match. And it's the difference between winning and losing. It really is. Six men, it's a different animal. You got subs. Guys shitty. Oops. Sorry, guys.
That's right.
Sorry, young listeners, earmuffs. guys doing bad, you sub them out, you bring in another guy, come back later and play good. You don't have that luxury in two men. It's just you and your partner. So if you want to chalk your partner under the bus, then just consider yourself a loser. You know, you're worse than your partner. As bad as your partner plays, if you give them attitude and bad body language and you don't help them, you're the worst player in my eyes. That's the guy I don't want to, I don't ever want to even think about as a partner. I want the guy that's going to light a fire under my ass, the guy that's going to yell at me when I need to be yelled at, or help me when I need to be helped, and never quit. I want a guy that never quits. So is there a drill that teaches a player to never quit? I don't know of one. That comes from cumulative, you know, just day after day of working and wanting to be that way, making a player realize that that's the level that you have to get at to be successful.
I think it's really cool to think about that as a skill. I think a lot of times we think of like, oh, I can improve their passing, I can improve their serving, but I can't get them to change their personality. And, you know, maybe that's a big stretch, but I think if you look at it day by day and, like you're saying, give feedback in the right places, we can get better at being a good teammate. And it is a huge skill, like you're saying.
To be honest, it's probably the skill that I know I would say most players from the golden era, that's the skill that we respect and we admire more than any skill in the game.
That's really cool to hear. So I know now you're assistant coaching at Florida International University, and you're a part of the college game. So I wanted to hear your impressions of the College Beach game and kind of wondering what your priorities are for coaching at that level. I know you kind of touched on it a little bit already.
Well, you know, 2 years ago, I was a volunteer head coach for my oldest daughter, Dallas, for her team at St. Mary's College up in Moragan in Northern California. And now this year, I'm the volunteer assistant coach for my youngest daughter's team at Florida International University. And I think that I might go a little bit sideways off this because I'm also a parent who has raised two daughters who grew up in the indoor club system. And to be honest with you, the day that I heard that sand volleyball was going to become a collegiate sport for women, I thought, wow. These poor girls that are subjected to, you know, from 10 years old to 18 years old, 24/7 indoor volleyball, they're going to finally get an outlet. They can finally get out on the beach and maybe have a little fun with volleyball. And maybe we might even create some healthier, happier young women playing volleyball. Because I really, in a lot of ways, detest the indoor club system and the way that they drive kids and kind of dangle scholarships in front of their noses and just a lot of the stuff that goes on. And I think young women, they at a certain point, they play so much volleyball. They're the most skilled 16 and 17 year old volleyball players I've seen. But I also see so many of them get into college and just not enjoy the game anymore and burn out. And so anyway, that's kind of my little side issue that I have my own problems with. But I was so excited to see sand volleyball become a collegiate sport. And I was excited initially to think that, you know, a player like Samantha Bricio could come out and play beach volleyball for a couple months after an indoor season and rest their joints, you know, and play some beach volleyball and maybe develop some different skills and have fun. And, you know, as it's developed, it seems that there are certain programs that are opening up the beach avenues to their indoor players and giving them kind of a creative outlet and a place to go and enjoy and learn and become better volleyball players, to be honest with you. But then again, I've seen a lot of schools that are the riff and the same old antiquated, you know, beach volleyball is bad for your timing, da 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 da, is happening. And there's already riffs and divisions and programs at universities where indoor players are banned from playing beach and beach can't, you know, and there's, I don't know, you know, we grew up and when we were on the national team down in San Diego, we trained from 8 till noon at the gym there. And then we would do an hour of jump training. Then we would go have lunch and we'd go down to the beach and we'd play all afternoon beach volleyball. We play indoor and sand day by day, side by side, and it never affected one ounce of our timing or anything. All it did was one sport helped the other. Indoor helped beach, beach helped indoor. We were just playing volleyball. And the more you play and the more you touch a ball, the better you're going to be. So, you know, I'm sad to see that already some of the antiquated ideas are raising their ugly faces, and the sand game in collegiately is barely off the ground. But I tell you, as a coach, it sure is a wonderful level to coach at. The girls try so hard. They care so much about it. They want to improve. And I've had some of the best coaching experiences I've had at St. Mary's and at FIU this year. Really fun.
I couldn't agree more with your thoughts on people wanting to tear the sports apart. I feel like they're both beautiful games and both complement each other, and I don't see any reason to separate them. So I hope that can change, but it doesn't look like it's going that direction.
It was interesting at St. Mary's. We had a couple of middle blockers that, you know, I mean, I had them rolling sets and turning their platforms over and getting away from the ball and playing balls out of the net. And they were in, they bought in 100%, and they were just loving trying to learn and perfect these nuances and these beach skills. And I swear, I mean, maybe it was just my own narrow sightedness or what, but those middles the next year indoors on bang bang plays where a setter would dig and it would go at them, they would set these fours and do these plays that I knew for a fact came from the ball control and the work that they did on the sand the year before. So, you know, I'm a firm believer that beach only helps indoors, and indoors definitely helps your skill. It doesn't quite help you as far as the mental side of beach volleyball, because indoors is such a different dynamic. But I think both sports, the more you play, the more they complement each other.
I love it. So you've seen a lot of the all-time greats and played with and against a lot of the all-time greats. I'm wondering who today, in today's game, you would pay to watch. And I know a lot of people don't get to see the international players as much, and you have. So I don't know, just some players that entertain you or that you love to watch, other than me and Billy.
Yeah. Yeah. Johnny, you know I would pay for any of your men. Yeah. Well, I certainly love to watch Phil and appreciate his skill and what he does. There's a little kid. I know you love him too, Johnny. Daniel Lupo. He's a defender from Italy. A kid that grew up in a little beach town in Italy, playing 3-on-3 at his club, and just a pure beach rat. And he does some great things on the court that's fun to watch. It's a lot of women I love to watch. I love to watch the way Laura Ludwig plays, just her fire, and Larissa, the Brazilian player. Certainly, Carrie and Misty were a treat for years and years to watch. There's a lot of really, really good international players. There's a guy named Fifi who plays defense, a Polish guy who's, I think, is amazing. Bruno, a Brazilian defender. Both those guys are barely 6 feet, and they can play. They can play this game. It's just amazing. But they're really fun players. Really fun players to watch. I've always loved watching Jake Gibb and his attitude and how he plays. And certainly Sean has given everyone their fair share of thrills and given me my fair share of headaches along with those thrills. So, but I love him. So, you know, all those guys, you know, that's our era. You know, like we talked about it, how you'd spend all day at the beach. I don't think you can be a coach, and I don't think you can do what I've done or if you don't love just watching the game. I love watching the game. I love seeing players react to different situations and how they react and how they respond and how they deal with the elements. And I just love every aspect of watching volleyball. And so that's why, you know, this has been a lot of fun.
Just nice to hear you recognize a lot of those players, because I feel like we get the rep of there's, you know, we're all just robots out there playing small game. But clearly there's a lot of personalities and fun players. I was just in Rio, and Emmanuel, I think at 42, just played his last tournament. And we were talking about, is he the greatest beach volleyball player of all time? And just curious your thoughts on that.
He certainly has probably the, you know, he and Karch would be the two for the longevity award as far as playing at such a high level for so many years. I know, again, you know, outside of having the mentality to always want to, you know, make your partner the best they can be and succeed, our era, and I think about any era, you know, the most respect or what I wanted to do is I wanted to be great for as long as I could be great. You know, that was my goal. It wasn't to win so many Opens one year, but to win as many as I could, as many years as I could, you know? So in that respect, Emmanuel, I would say is right there with Karch. But whether he's as great a player as Gene Selznick or as Kent Steffes, I would be hard pressed to say he is, you know, better than those guys. But those guys didn't play as long as he did. So, you know, he's got the longevity award, and he's certainly one of the greatest players to ever play. But I wouldn't put him as the number, you know, I played a few matches against him, granted, when he was very young. But I wouldn't put him better than Karch or better than Stokey or St. John or Kent or any of our great players. I just, you know, he's great. There's no doubt.
Yeah, for sure. And he's another guy who's.
I'm not going to put him above any of our greats, for sure.
Yeah, I think he's a guy who's a great teammate, like we talked about before.
Yeah, he's proven it. I mean, his record is amazing.
So kind of my last question, and I think Billy had some rapid fires. I was wondering just regrets, if you had any regrets from your playing career, anything you would have done differently that we can learn from?
From my playing career, I can't have any regrets. I was as lucky as any human can be as far as timing goes, because I was very, very good player, but not Emmanuel and not Karch, but I was at a really, really good era for volleyball. And so I was really lucky. So I have no regrets as a player. You know, maybe at that birthday at that Seattle Open on Saturday night, I had a couple less beers and done better the next day. You know, maybe Hav and I had a little too much fun at some points and didn't win as many as maybe we could have, but we won a lot and we had a lot of fun. So I have no regrets. I the coaching, it's a little more of a, it makes me think and wonder sometimes if I sacrificed a lot coaching financially, time away from family. So that sometimes I wonder if that was the right thing for me to do. I enjoyed doing it. And I had this belief that it would grow and become a really good, viable profession. And hopefully someday it still will, but it just didn't happen in my time. But I don't regret it. It's just, it was something I did. Sometimes I think, you know, like what if I'd have just been, you know, selling real estate and developing and doing, you know, what I kind of did part-time, full-time, all that time I was coaching. I'd probably have more money, but I wouldn't have the memories and I wouldn't have the satisfaction of giving what I gave to the sport. So, you know, it's not a regret, but, you know, then again, it's just something that is what it is. But let's not end this on that.
No.
Mike, I got some rapid fire old school versus new school questions.
Go ahead, Billy.
All right. Side out versus rally.
Side out.
Winner stays on work up all day long or drill for 2 hours?
Winner stays all day long.
Heavy leather ball versus the light ball now.
Light ball.
All right. Save the shoulder.
Yep.
Neon elastic shorts versus black board shorts.
Board shorts.
Tim Hovland tearing his shirt versus Patterson dancing.
It's not even close.
Yeah.
Hob will kill you for that comparison.
Even the comparison side.
64 team event or a 16 team tournament?
64.
Beach chairs versus bleachers?
Bleachers.
Right side or left side?
Well, right side, of course.
Yeah.
Don't. My resume on the left is not so stellar.
Jumbo versus cut shot.
Cut shot.
All right. Manhattan Open versus Klagenfurt.
Manhattan.
Let's see. This one might not make any sense, but Dane Selznick and St. John Smith versus Phil Dalhouser and Ryan Doherty.
St. John and Phil.
St. John and Phil.
Let's just put St. John and Phil together. I think they could probably beat a few teams right now.
Yeah, I've played you in a couple of those Legends matches, and you guys still got it.
Quick side note. Mike played – I was training with – he was coaching the Italian national team, and Mike was coaching that team, and he invited me down. And one day one of the Italians was hurt, so Mike stepped in at – I don't know how old you were at the time. in your 50s.
Yes.
And
yes.
Absolutely,
that's very kind. Thanks.
Absolutely dominated. Like Doug, he knew where I was hitting before I did. He was siding out every ball. I walked away from that practice like, what am I doing out here? He's so much better than me.
You weren't the only one. Those Italians were kind of shaking their heads too.
That was a soul shaker. It woke me up a little bit.
Well, we had a couple of those. I was a little bit younger, and I was coaching Jake, and one day Rosie was hurt, and Stolfus and Wachfogel were they had just taken a couple fists, and they were playing really well, and Jake and I played them and just gave them a waxing, and then they never recovered from that. They were just – it did some psychological damage.
I could see that. They haven't been seen since, huh?
And then a couple of years later, Sean Scott and I did the same thing to the Kiwis, Kurt and Jason. They were never the same.
Yeah.
The only story I have of ever playing with you is I came to one of the practices you were running, and I think Phil, whoever was doing hitting lines or was setting, they were out warming up or stretching, and so you stepped in, and you were talking about your platform earlier, and I don't know, I had been working on squaring up, being super simple, all of this stuff that was just like, you know, line, just perfect lines. And we started tossing you balls, and it was like sideways platform, spinning the ball. But every single one was coming off just dead perfect. And it was like the best sets I've ever hit. It was unbelievable. And I think I came home and I was explaining this to my wife, and she's like, I don't understand. That doesn't make sense. You're supposed to stand here and do it this way. And it was like, yeah, I know. I don't know what he did. It was pretty unbelievable.
Well, thanks. Glad.
I'll throw in my one Mike Dodge story. We were playing the Legends match, not this last year, but the year before, and you were setting. But one time you dug in transition, and so I was at the net. So I turned and set you. It was like a back set, and I was like, Mike, you're ready. And I set you, and you like got to the ball, and like I kind of surprised you, and you hit it. You got a kill, might have hit the tape and went down.
I think it dribbled over. Yeah,
you're like, don't do that again.
We're supposed to look good out here. Don't do that.
Best spiker award. All right, I got a winning by Skyball to run out the clock versus Let's Serve Trickler Ace.
Well, I guess it would be either one sucks. So let's
leave it at that. Good answer.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for answering.
No worries.
Cool.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Just to wrap up, I wanted to thank you. And I guess you said you talked about, you know, regretting the coaching or possibly, you know, considering if it was the right decision. But I guess for me, when I first started playing, I think it was around the time you got into coaching, and you were always like really supportive and in my corner, I felt like, and to have someone like you to do that from the start just meant so much. And it's probably why I'm still playing. And you've always just been, yeah, just so supportive to me, and it's meant a lot. So I just want to thank you for all
thanks,
your
time
in my career.
That means a lot. And, you know, it's funny because I was always coaching one team, but I really felt strongly like I was kind of a supporter for our whole group, you know, and I tried to do that and tried to help all of us collectively be as good as our country could be. It meant a lot to me, and thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, just thanks for all you've done for our sport, and I hope we can do everything we can to keep you around, and maybe I'll give you Donald Sun's number after this.
Sounds good.
Throw some of your ideas to him.
That was awesome, fun. Guys. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.